Set phasers for stun and prepare for warp speed. It's time for the We Got the Geeks movie talk.
So, we love movies as far back as we can remember. We'll do our best to review new stuff, and we do like to, on occasion, look back at older stuff as well. Some of the older stuff we've actually missed, which is odd.
That's what happens when you have a kid.
Well, no, like even older stuff from the 80s in recent months I've discovered for the first time.
Oh, that. There's probably a reason I didn't see them in the 80s.
Some of the sillier movie reviews are going to probably occur when we have John and Ryan here. They always pick out some zany movies from the 80s that we always review.
True that.
But this week...
I like when the boys come over and you get to watch movies with them and I get to go do my own thing. But I guess I'll have to be included in some of them now.
That's right.
Damn it.
All right. So to begin with, let's explain something we decided to throw on ourselves last December. So they released the 22nd, 23rd James Bond movie last December called Skyfall.
314, I don't know.
So at that time, I had mentioned to a bunch of people that I'd never seen a James Bond movie. And that always, the reaction from that was always disgust,
yep,
or head shaking, or how could you have never seen a James Bond movie in your life? Just, I never got around to watching them. I know it's odd. You'd only seen a few, and you can't even remember which few you saw, right?
No.
I know you saw one of the Pierce Brosnan movies, I think, when we were dating, with your mom, maybe.
I think it was with Rose, but yeah.
Okay. And you mentioned you might have seen Roger Moore movies growing up.
Yeah, my parents watched them, so I think I've seen parts of them. Maybe all of them.
I was always a fan of some of the music.
Yeah.
I love the Duran Duran song, A View to a Kill. Love Live and Let Die by Paul McCartney. So they've always had some good tunes. Maybe not so much from this one that we're about to review.
No.
But on the old show... We started in December reviewing them right from the beginning. So we started with the classic Sean Connery movies. And you love Sean Connery, old and new. Younger and older. And we had a fairly good time with the first five movies. I think the best of those was Goldfinger. And as we watched each movie, we discovered, wow, Austin Powers really did steal a bunch of stuff from those movies. Including Blofeld from the last movie. Totally Dr. Evil's whole look. The bald head, the scar.
Yeah.
The gray suit, the cat.
Like when they revealed them, I knew it was going to be similar. I didn't know it was going to be exact.
Yeah. And in the early movies, we just saw this character basically from the back where you saw him petting a cat. He didn't really talk. Showed up in the last one. Had more of a presence in the new one. Well, the newer one we reviewed. So unfortunately, after the first five Sean Connery movies, there was a movie that he had no part of. On Her Majesty's Secret Service, which featured a young up and coming star slash model, George Lazenby, which I've also heard his name pronounced Lazenby, but for all purposes, I'm going to say Lazenby.
My vice principal in high school was Mr. Lazenby, so I don't say Lazenby. I always say Lazenby because of that.
Lazenby sounds good.
You needed to know that. It was important.
Oh, we'll fill you in with all these important facts about movies and our own personal life as time goes on. But this was the first one without Connery. This was from December 1969, so about 6 months after I was born. The other ones we reviewed were before my time.
You can't do math. It was five.
Five, okay.
Love you.
Well, someone's got it. And so you discovered he was one of England's biggest models at the time. This is one of his first movies.
Yeah, I think it was Australia, but... He was like the most well-paid model at the time, and this was his first movie.
They'd had lots of actors audition when Connery said he didn't want to come back, including Timothy Dalton, which is funny because he played him in the late 80s. But they chose this model, unknown guy. Really, we haven't seen any of his work after this James Bond movie. You looked him up on IMDb. He was on Superboy. He was Jor-El.
Yeah, there you go.
He was Superman's dad. And then he was in a bunch of raunchy movies. The Emmanuel series, I believe.
Yeah, the French very softcore adult films.
Do you remember the show The Man from U.N.C.L.E., another spy show before our time? Guess there was a reunion in the 80s, The Return of the Man from U.N.C.L.E. And there was a cameo from Lazenby who drove up in an Aston Marin. Is that the name
of
the
Aston Martin?
Or Aston Martin. I always mess that up. I'm not a car guy.
Nope.
I guess this character drove up to the Men from U.N.C.L.E. and they just called him JB. And he made some comment about Her Majesty's Secret Service and drove away. That's pretty much this guy's career. So at the time, I guess the producers offered him 7 James Bond movies. They figured he was going to be the next big thing. And little did they know that during the filming, he was going to say, mm-mm, I'm only doing the one. That's it. I'm through. But that's another story for another time. I guess he really liked making the producers mad as well. He showed up to the premiere in December, and he had a big, giant beard and long hair. And they said, could you maybe shave and cut your hair to look a little bit James Bond-like for the premiere? And he wouldn't do it. He looked like Grizzly Adams, I guess.
Nice.
So, much like the other James Bond movies, it had a opening pre-credit scene where he was on the beach in his tuxedo fighting some men. And you had also found out that he had trained for martial art through the one and only legendary Bruce Lee.
Yeah, and he was, like, close personal friends with Bruce Lee. It wasn't that he just trained with him. He, like, full-on knew him and was supposed to have dinner with him the night he died and all this stuff. But it's like, you wouldn't be able to tell that by watching this movie.
Yeah, I hope he didn't have to pay for his fighting lessons because he looked goofy in all his fighting scenes. I made a note here to mention the dumb-looking kick fight in the water at the beginning of the movie where he was just jumping around and kicking, and it looked really ridiculous.
Yeah. Like, usually you think of Bruce Lee, and you think of, like, strategic fighting, and he just looked like
fighter.
He was flailing around in the water. Like, give him a beach ball and a hula hoop.
His wet tuxedo. And he ends up rescuing Diana Rigg, who plays a big part in the later plot of the movie. But then he has this very dumb moonlighting moment after he finishes this fight, looks right at the camera, and says, this never happened to the other fella, meaning Sean Connery. There's a time and a place for breaking the third wall, and it's not in a James Bond movie.
No.
And then, just to make you remember that you're watching a James Bond movie and not some new movie, In the credits sequence, they show all kinds of clips from the earlier movies of all the different women that James Bond has slept with and some of the villains, and it's a cool credit sequence.
Oh yeah.
And they had an instrumental theme which just actually sounded pretty cool. They couldn't figure out how to get On Her Majesty's Secret Service, the title, into a song. And yeah, it was a cool credit sequence. Then we had to get back to the actual movie, I guess.
Yeah.
And James Bond's been hunting for Blofeld for the last 2 years, and he hasn't found him, and they decide to pull him off the case, and that does not make him happy. So he decides to quit and hand in his resignation. But lo and behold, Miss Moneypenny to the rescue.
She fixes everything.
Fixes it, so he just asked for a 2-week leave or whatever it was, and he didn't really resign. So he goes off on his own. Another thing I want to mention, the very beginning, I love the James Bond theme. I did not like how they mangled the James Bond theme in this. They had these weird keyboards instead of the familiar James Bond guitar part.
Yeah, you were really pissed.
Like, what's up with the keyboards? So they got rid of Connery and the guy that played the guitar on the theme song?
Yep.
So anyhow, getting back to the review.
Maybe Connery was the guy on the guitar.
Oh, that would make sense. So he goes off, runs into the girl that he rescued at the beginning of the movie, her dad decides, I'm going to pay you £1 million. Is that what it was in British money? If you marry my daughter. And then he goes into this really gross description of she just needs someone to have someone to make love to her. Like, dude, that's your daughter. I don't know how it is over there in England, but in the 60s, that was very gross. But that's okay, because then we got the James Bond going on a date montage.
Falling in love.
The falling in love montage, which there's another thing. Is there really a do we really need a going on a date montage in a James Bond movie?
No.
And that was while they were doing their falling in love montage, we got to hear Louis Armstrong's final song that he ever recorded, We Have All the Time in the World, which was the very last sentence said in the movie as well, which we'll get to in a couple minutes. So following the falling in love montage, yes, I've said that 15 times now, there was another fight scene, and you noticed this right away. I had to go back and watch it, but it looked like the fight scene had been sped up, like way too much.
Yeah, like it looks like they choreographed it really slow. So nobody got, like, I have this whole backstory in my head that they were like doing it normal speed, like a real fight scene, and somebody got like really hurt. So they were like, okay, we're going to do it again really slow so nobody gets hurt. So they slowed it down so that everybody could hit their marks choreographically. Is that a word?
It is now.
Okay. And then they sped it up so that it wouldn't look like it was a slow fight, but they like hit the notch like one too many. So instead of being at like 100%, it was at 103%. So it was just that touch too fast.
Well, here's a theory. Maybe Sean Connery was the guy that was in charge of speeding up the fight, and he was gone, so they hired some unknown guy.
So he was the actor, the guitar player, and the fight choreographer, speeder-upper guy.
Yes, I think so.
So yeah, it was just like, just a scotch too fast, so it almost looked comical.
Like, it did.
Like those Benny Hill skits when they go running around and they're running in and out of the doors and they're running all over the grounds and everything and they're going really fast. That's how it looked. A little bit slower than that. But then they had to dub in the slaps and the punches.
Yes.
And they were like over loud.
Overcompensating.
It was just... And then off-putting. Like, I couldn't even watch.
And at one point in that fight, he was using a butter knife to fight a guy. And then he hit a girl. Like, flat-on punched a girl. After telling her to get dressed, which is something you never would have seen Sean Connery do.
It's like he's never seen a James Bond movie.
James Bond wants you to get undressed, not dressed.
Durr.
Oh, boy. What else can I say about this lovely movie?
I don't know.
Oh, okay. So he finally tracks down Blofeld in Switzerland. And he's up in the mountains. You have to take called a tram? Or a ski tram to get to him? One of those things on the cables?
The ski lifts?
Monorail. No, it's not a ski. It's probably like a big ski lift. It looked like a bus.
Yeah, I think it was a monorail, maybe. I don't know.
Maybe. I don't know. But he goes up there and he's in disguise. In a real dumb disguise.
And he disguised himself as Sherlock.
Yeah, Sherlock Holmes hat, big glasses, a pipe, turtleneck. By the way, let's get on to how he was dressed for a second. He was the worst dressed James Bond. He had all these turtleneck outfits and a kilt at one point.
That was the 60s for you.
But Connery always had the coolest outfits.
It's Connery, still does.
Still does, yeah. But he's in disguise, and I can't remember the name of the character he's pretending to be. I guess Lazenby couldn't do the accent he was supposed to be doing, so they had to get another guy to dub in the voice for when he was disguised.
Like, how dumb is that?
I know.
There's a reason he's the best paid model. Models don't talk, just saying.
Yeah. And then this brings me to my next point. And Connery did it, too. The bad puns they would give James Bond in these early movies. So when he's in the kilt, he said something like, I feel a slight stiffness coming on. Which I don't remember why he said it.
I don't know.
there's another fight later on where a guy gets knocked off his skis on a branch, and he said, oh, he branched off or something like that. So he escapes on skis down the mountain. And the henchmen chasing after him in the orange jackets and hats reminded me of the henchmen on the old Batman TV show.
Oh, for sure.
They chase him down the hill. And the one cool thing I saw in a fight in that movie happens. He jumps off his... He loses a ski and skis down on one ski. Then he stops. Then he uses his one ski to, like, knock a couple guys off the mountain, which looked kind of cool. Gets to the bottom of the hill, disguises himself yet again, runs into this Teresa, the one that he had the falling in love montage with. They escape in her car. Somehow they find him, and they have a car chase. And lo and behold, while they're having their car chase, they somehow discover a big stock car race going on in Switzerland. And then just drive right into it.
Yeah.
And the race is still going on while they're being chased.
I'm
going
to be part of this race.
They get away. They have to hold up for the night because of the snow. And then all of a sudden, he just proclaims his love for the girl. I love you. Marry me. A couple scenes ago, you had slept with someone up on the mountain. By the way, that's the key plot of the movie. When he runs into Blofeld, this time played by Telly Savalas, TV's Kojak.
Which was really cool.
He's got these 11 or 12 women that he keeps hypnotizing, and I guess they're the carriers of all these diseases. They're going to come down and make everyone allergic to stuff.
Yeah, allergies. That's what's going to
happen. Yeah, but that's okay. James Bond still slept with one of them. He was in disguise, though.
So that's okay.
That's okay, then. It wasn't really James Bond. It was the right Sherlock Holmes disguise with the dub voice. So they're in love. Long story short, this Teresa Bond gets kidnapped yet again. They go back to the mountain where they're fighting a guy that looks like William Catt from The Greatest American Hero.
Yep.
I don't get that. He's sneaking around on top of the tram with, it looks like he pulled a sock out of his crotch. I call it his James Bond crotch sock. Diana heard it wrong and said it was his garage sock, baby.
Yep.
So he slides down and... yeah. So they're fighting on the mountain, and they have to ski. Too many ski scenes in this movie, by the way.
Yep.
And one of the things that pissed you off in the final ski chase was the girl didn't put her ski mask on, her goggles.
Her goggles. She took her goggles off. They, like, had skied halfway down the mountain. They still had more skiing to do, and she takes her goggles off. Everybody else left their goggles on. So it's like, okay, take them off, have a conversation, put them back on, start skiing again. No, she didn't put them back on, and they just started skiing again. And the henchmen are chasing them. And then there's this one part where there's this snowplow thing. Like, I don't ski, so I don't understand why there was a snowplow in the middle of the mountain.
Yeah, on the mountain.
Like, clearing a divot.
Yeah.
So, of course, henchman doesn't make it over this chasm. And
oh, he gets knocked right into the wood chipper.
Well, it was the snowplow, but yeah, it was like the wood chipper scene from Fargo.
And the guy got knocked. The one henchman got ripped up in it. To which James Bond said something clever, like, "That's a lot of guts."
He had a lot of guts.
He had a lot of guts.
And so then they're like skiing through it, like this thing is like spewing out blood and guts onto the snow. Diana Rigg doesn't have her goggles on.
Still.
Maybe you want to have your goggles on before you ski through blood and guts.
It's true.
Maybe. I don't know. Like I said, I don't ski, so maybe you don't. I don't know. It's just something I thought I would like to have on my face before skiing through someone's entrails.
It would make sense, right? And then following that, there's a toboggan. Was it a toboggan chase? Between Telly Savalas and George Lazenby. It looked like a big luge track down the mountain.
Yep.
And that went on entirely too long. So let's get to the end of the movie, because that was kind of the only cool part of the whole movie. In a really bad way, but it was cool. So Bond gets married, which is... a big thing for him, seeing how he sleeps with five women a movie.
True.
And they never wrote that into a Sean Connery movie. So he gets married to this Teresa, who's now Teresa Bond, and he doesn't even take the £1 million from the creepy dad who wanted them to have sex. So they drive away. And by the way, like in six James Bond movies, the most heartbreaking thing I've seen is Miss Penny, Moneypenny's face as she's at the wedding watching them get married.
It was so sad.
Because he's hit on her in every one of the movies to the point of sexual harassment.
Sweet sexual harassment.
Yeah, yeah. And speaking of which, speaking of James Bond characters, Q didn't do a lot in this movie. Didn't make any gadgets for him to use.
He made radioactive lint.
Which he didn't even use.
So maybe it'll come up in another James Bond movie.
Ooh, maybe.
But they've never done that before.
I don't know.
Maybe Sean Connery was in charge of making sure that Q's gadgets got used.
Maybe. So they get married. They drive away. I don't understand why he had to stop the car in the middle of the highway. Oh, to get the flowers off the wedding car. That's what you do when before you get to your destination.
Yeah. Just because some kids drove by going, oh, say it with flowers.
Yeah.
Oh, I guess I should get those off the car right now in the middle. Like, it was one of those roads on the side of a mountain.
Yeah, like going up a cliff or something.
Like overlooking the ocean and stuff. I'm going to stop right here. Get these flowers off.
This is necessary right now, right this minute.
They're not in the windshield. They're tacked to the back of the car.
Yeah, they weren't even blocking his view or anything.
Really? You're James Bond. She skis without goggles. I think the flowers are okay.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So in doing so, Kojak and his partner drive up and shoot her. And we're sitting there like going, how are they going to explain him being married? Like they don't bring it up in the other movies, I don't think. And then she dies.
And that is how.
And of course, the cops pull up. Do you need some help? And his last words were, no, we have all the time in the world. She's just sleeping.
She's resting.
She's resting.
No, she's bleeding out on your lap is what she's doing.
And that's how it ended. Credits. That last scene, I guess, was supposed to be the beginning of the next James Bond movie. But because Lazenby decided not to come back, they just tacked it on at the end of the movie. The wedding scene was supposed to be the last scene. So, that's about all I had to say about that movie. Lucky for us, Sean Connery did come back for the seventh James Bond movie. From what I read, it was like, offer Sean Connery anything he wants to come back. And that'll bring us into the 70s with Diamonds Are Forever. I guess it's kind of cool looking back at the different James Bonds to see how they portrayed the character, but I think they made a mistake with a male model. And I guess he's like a punchline in jokes now.
Yep.
There was an example. There was a Doctor Who TV movie that came out in the mid-90s. This was after it had been off the BBC for a few years. And they were hoping to make a TV series out of it. And it didn't happen. So it was just a TV movie in 96. Years later, Doctor Who came back. But the guy that played him was a guy by the name of Paul McGann. And when they ask him about that, he always says, I'm the George Lazenby of the Doctor Who franchise. It's hilarious to me. So yeah, that's it.
It wasn't good.
No.
It wasn't good.
All right, so next up, we decided to look back on another franchise, as if looking back on a James Bond franchise wasn't bad enough. So Valentine's Day, A Good Day to Die Hard is coming out, the fifth Die Hard movie.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you were listening to the intro of our show, we mentioned that we're big fans of the Die Hard series. It's my favorite action movie of all time. 1988, though, and we were having this discussion before. Can you believe it's been 25 years since the first Die Hard?
No.
And were you even supposed to go to Die Hard? Had you made plans to see it?
Nope. I was supposed to... I was with Yolanda, and we were going to go see Cocktail. I'd already seen Cocktail. I don't think she had seen it. So I was going to go see it again. And then we got to the movie theater like 10, 15 minutes late. So we were like, it's not really worth seeing. Like, we've already missed the beginning. So we just asked the ticket guy, what's the next movie playing? Die Hard. You want to see Die Hard? I guess. We're already here.
And at this point, you were familiar with him on Moonlighting.
Right? I knew him on Moonlighting. I had pictures of Bruce Willis in my locker, for sure.
I was a fan of his from Moonlighting. Always thought he was a great comedic actor. Never in a million years would have thought he would be, like, the next big action hero.
No. And he was doing the Seagram's ads, too, right?
He did the Seagram's. He had had Blind Date by that point. And I think he had the James Garner Western. I'm drawing a blank on the name of the
Sunset
movie.
Sunset?
Yeah, yeah. So he had two comedies out at that point. His third movie was Die Hard, which is, as you know, the big, huge action movie, which set the bar high for future action movies.
Yeah.
Do you remember for a time there, like a five-year period there, where anytime there was an action movie, they would compare it to Die Hard?
Yep.
Like Speed was Die Hard on a bus.
Uh-huh.
And there was a Wesley Snipes movie, Passenger 57.
Yeah.
Die Hard on a Plane.
Which was then Die Hard 2.
Yeah, and they just compared him like that for a while. And you weren't a fan of Die Hard 2. We saw it together after we were dating years later.
Yeah.
But you loved 3?
Yeah.
With a Vengeance, which really was the true sequel to the first movie. And then, of course, 7 years ago, I can't believe it's been that long, we saw Live Free or Die Hard. And by the way, back then, could you imagine that over 10 years later, we'd be getting another John McClane movie?
No.
I thought that franchise was done. And we decided to look back on that movie this week, because we'd only seen it a couple times 7 years ago. I bought the DVD that year, because it had an unrated version on it, where they kept in all the swearing.
As it should be.
Because the first three McClane movies were rated R, and then for some reason, the fourth one was rated PG. To the point of he couldn't say his famous catchphrase. Yippee-ki-yay, you know. They cut it out. They had a gunshot at the end of Yippee-ki-yay. And I remember when I bought the DVD, that was the first scene. I, like, skipped it right, too, just to make sure he said it.
Yep.
And I've said this a million times. The first three diehards, all he did, McClane did, was smoke and swear. You can't all of a sudden take that away from the character. And you figured he'd be a lot more bitter in the last one because they mentioned he'd been divorced and his kids hated him. So that's more reason to swear.
Yep.
So Live Free and Die Hard came out in 2007. His co-star was Justin Long, who at the time was doing the I'm a Mac, I'm a PC ads.
It was Mac, man.
And I got to admit, I'm not a big fan of that kid, but he was all right in this movie. Like, he was a pretty good, decent sidekick. He was no Samuel L. Jackson, obviously.
No.
Or even a Reginald Bell Johnson. But he was all right. And we got introduced to McClane's older daughter, Lucy, who does a cameo in the new one, I guess.
Oh, okay, cool.
And it fits the timeline. If you watch, go back and watch the first Die Hard, his kids were like little kids. They showed him little kids watching the TV. Come home, I remember they said, when they heard about their parents being stuck in the Nakatomi Plaza. So the timeline's right. They'd be in their 20s by now. And I'm drawing a blank. What's the name of the actor who was the villain in this movie? The Justified
Timothy
guy?
Timothy Oliphant.
Yeah, there's this big plot where they're going to shut down all the power in the United States and all the phone lines and all the traffic, shut that right down. And it turns out to just be a pretty much a bank heist, right?
Have a fire sale.
Fire sale, yeah. And it's scary, man. Like, something like that would be scary in real life. So they hire all these computer hackers to get all this information for them, and then they kill the hackers off one by one. That's how Bruce Willis gets brought into it. He's assigned to protect Justin Long, who's a hacker. So he takes him in. They get in all sorts of wacky John McClane adventures. At one point, they run into Kevin Smith, who's the warlock in this one. Funny as hell scene.
Yeah.
Some of the scenes are a little over the top if you compare them to the first couple diehards. In those movies, he was alone in a building, and he had to hide and sneak around and just shoot terrorists. In this one, he drove a car into a helicopter.
Well, the first scene when he's, like, picking up Justin Long at his apartment, and they're trying to assassinate Justin Long. Like, that was really good.
Yeah.
It was very Die Hard-like.
Oh, yeah.
Then it got a little off course.
Yeah, and then He's in a 18-wheeler rig at the end, taking on a jet that's firing at him and blowing up the highway, and somehow he manages to destroy the jet and jump out of the truck. And
yeah,
it was a little unbelievable. I remember it looked cool in the theater, at least. Like, it didn't look dumb or anything, but it seemed like a little unrealistic for John McClane. And it was good. It was good revisiting it again. It's funny. I'd seen the other three Die Hards a couple times in the last 7 years, but I never had gone back to rewatch this one. And the swearing does help. I know that seems stupid, but the swearing does help a little bit.
Well, you're going through something like that. You're not going to scream, "Oh, fiddlesticks!"
Oh, darn it! I jumped off a truck.
Ah, shoot. Phooey.
So that being said, we're very excited about the new one. Again, it's been 7 years. I never expected to get another McClane movie now, because he's 57 years old now, Bruce Willis.
He's 50.
Still in good shape. Still looks cool. The plot of the new one is he has to go to Russia to rescue his adult son. And it comes out on Valentine's Day as well, which is funny, I think. It's a nice romantic movie.
Yeah.
But it leads me to believe February is not a big time for releasing movies. Do you think they have a lot of faith in this one?
I don't think so.
It's usually a dumping ground. But then I went back and looked through all the other ones, and as each Die Hard came out, they would make a little more money than the previous movie. Then again, it's a pretty jam-packed summer this year.
Yeah, that was the other thing I was thinking. To get a weekend where you didn't have any other competition.
Yeah.
But to move it all the way out to February, like, I don't know. It's set in Russia, and I think it's set, like, in the cold winter months of Russia.
Yeah.
So, yeah, maybe something you don't want to go see, like, in August.
Maybe.
Although I did see Die Hard in the summertime, and that was a Christmas movie.
Yeah, the first two Die Hard movies took place at Christmas, and they were out in the summer. Actually, I think the first four Die Hards were actually out in the summertime. It's a big action, go-to-the-movies-in-the-summer deal. But this summer's jam-packed. There's at least two blockbusters every week this summer. There's already too many movies that I don't know how we're going to get to see.
We'll figure it out.
Make sure they're babysitter-worthy. And as I was doing my Die Hard research, I had known that the first Die Hard movie was based on a book, but I never really researched it further than that. And here's some interesting things about this book. It was a book by a guy named Roderick Thorpe, came out in 1979, called Nothing Lasts Forever. And it does have a lot of similarities to Die Hard, but there's a lot of different things as well. For example, the lead character's name isn't John McClane, it's Joe Leland. He's a cop who's just retired. He'd been in World War II, so he's an older guy, obviously.
Yeah.
And he goes to visit his daughter in L.A. on Christmas Eve. Kind of similar, like in the movie, is obviously his wife on Christmas Eve.
Yeah.
And it's in a giant skyscraper. And they have terrorists taking over the building, like in the movie. And then he's got to run around and save them. And reading the description, his daughter and grandchildren are in the building.
Okay.
Obviously, they took some liberties because Bruce Willis at the time was in his 30s when he did this movie. And he's aided by Sergeant Al Powell, like in the movie, Reginald Bell Johnson. But this guy's way younger than Bruce Willis. He's like, than the character, he's like 22 years old. He's a brand new cop. And here's a really interesting fact. So this Roderick Thorpe guy wrote this as a sequel to another book he had written called The Detective. And he wrote this because this book, The Detective, got made into a movie starring Frank Sinatra as his lead character. So in an alternate universe, Frank Sinatra was John McClane.
Weird.
So he wrote this book as a follow-up, hoping that Sinatra would do the movie. And due to some contract, when they wrote the movie as Die Hard, they had to offer Frank Sinatra the role first. At the time, Sinatra was 72 years old. Could you see him jumping off a building with a hose wrapped around him?
Yippee-ki-yay.
With glass in his feet?
Come out to the coast.
Oh, geez. Luckily for us, he said no. And then I guess Bruce Willis wasn't even their first choice because, as we mentioned, he was just a funny guy on a TV show at the time. And then there's a lot of similarities in the book that made it into the movie. The book had him taping the gun to his back at the end when he shot Hans Gruber. He had him crawling through elevator shafts. He dropped the C4 bomb down an elevator shaft. The famous scene at the end where he jumps off the roof with the fire hose, that was in the book. I kind of want to hunt down this book and read it now. It sounds interesting. I can't get over the fact that Frank Sinatra might have been John McClane.
Yeah. That's something I want to see.
Oh, geez.
And I totally have, like, Joe Piscopo as Frank Sinatra in my head.
Well, they'd have to use him, obviously.
Tell him, Steve.
Oh, that's awesome. Oh, and I did not know this. When Frank Sinatra declined the role, it was then changed into a sequel to the Arnold Schwarzenegger film Commando. Schwarzenegger turned down the role, so the script was retooled in 1988 for the standalone story Die Hard.
Wow.
I didn't even know that part, the Last Commando thing. That's hilarious. So we might not be sitting here today talking about Die Hard if these movies had come to pass.
Yeah. That's crazy talk.
Can you imagine that my favorite action movie of all time might have been a Frank Sinatra movie?
No.
So that being said, we're definitely excited about A Good Day to Die Hard coming your way on the romantic holiday of Valentine's Day. Already booked off the day. We're going to go with our friend Andrea.
True story.
It's going to be a good time. So that brings us to our last review, which we've had a copy of for a good 4 or 5 months. It's just been sitting on our shelf. You were very excited about it last summer when it came out in the theaters. Your opinion's probably changed since we've seen it.
Maybe.
So it was the movie musical based on a play, Rock of Ages, starring Tom Cruise. I was about to say Tom Green. That would have been a different kind of movie.
That would have been interesting.
Yeah. Tom Cruise, Malin Ackerman, Alec Baldwin. I always want to say Adam. My bodyguard guy.
I want to see Adam Baldwin and Tom Green in a movie now.
Let's write that up. Maybe we cast them in a movie.
Let's make this happen.
Russell Brand and Juliana Hough from Dancing with the Stars.
I think she's from Dancing with the Stars. Oh.
Now, before we get to the bad things, the interesting part of this movie was the music. It's all stuff that we I wouldn't say we went out of our way to listen to in the 80s.
It was the only thing to listen to in the 80s.
Well, I had friends that were into that music, so that's how I became familiar with it. I was into Guns N' Roses a little bit. Don't let the hair throw you. I was strictly a Springsteen Mellencamp guy back then.
Huey Lewis.
Looking back on it now, don't so much hate those songs anymore. It's a lot better than some of the music we're getting now, and I can find some good in most of the songs in the 80s now.
Like I was a top 40 80s kid for sure. But all that stuff was in the top 40. Like it was those songs.
All those hair bands from the mid to late 80s.
They weren't making like deep album cuts to get the music for this. This was the popular music.
Yeah, they picked like the big hits. A lot of Foreigner. There was, I think, 3 Foreigner songs in the movie. Some Poison, some Guns N' Roses.
Starship
of all bands. We built this city. Twisted Sister, which was a record you actually owned,
Quiet
I guess.
Quiet Riot.
So to us, we're from the. It's safe to say our generation was the 80s. So we're familiar with all the tunes there, and
I did sing along with the whole movie.
I kind of did too, which was odd. And I think my friend Dennis would want to see it just for the music as well. So basically, there's this club. Where would the movie take place? In L.A.?
Yeah.
Because that's where a lot of these bands actually came from. Like, the culture in the 80s, there is a I guess it's based maybe on the Whiskey Room, which is in L.A. That's where Motley Crue got their start, and Guns N' Roses, and all those guys. Bourbon Room in the movie, which, did we mention it was based on a play as well? Big, famous Broadway play.
Yeah, which I wish... I've always had this thing with, like, Broadway plays that I want to go. I've never been in New York City to hang out. I've driven through it when I was 8 years old in December and wasn't a fan. I don't want to, like, go visit New York City. I don't see the appeal. And I know I have friends that go there all the time and they love it. And I've said this since I was, like, I want to say, like, 13, and I saw the movie Chorus Line with Catherine Zeta-Jones' husband, Michael Douglas.
And you actually downloaded that album for us, too.
My dream New York vacation would be to fly into New York, get a ride from the airport to Broadway, see a play, take that car back to the airport, and fly home. I don't want to see anything else in New York.
Well,
I just want to see Broadway plays.
I would want to take a stop off at the DC Comics offices before we left.
Nope,
we're done.
Because they won't be open. It's nighttime to see a play.
Right.
And then we go. And this dream was long before I knew you, sir. But so I've always wanted to see Broadway plays. I don't have the money to go to Toronto. Like, now I live so much closer to somewhere that actually I can get Broadway caliber plays. I don't have the money to go up there and do that. Like, there's been so many plays up in Toronto that I've wanted to see, and it's like, oh, nope, no money for that.
Well, I would love to check out the...
Jersey Boys?
I'm drawing a blank again. The South Park guys played
Book of Mormon. Yeah.
Right. And somehow, if it comes true that Kevin Smith is doing a Clerks Broadway show, we're going to find a way to get there.
Okay.
Anyhow... So
I've always wanted to see Rock of Ages was pretty much what it came down
to. Yeah. Well, the music was pretty good. Some of the storyline. So Tom Cruise is this big rocker guy named Stacy Jacks, who everyone loves, and he's doing his farewell concert with his band, about to go solo. Big alcoholic, like, you know.
Not sure if he's just leaving or if the band's kicked him out.
Yeah.
There are rumors on both sides.
And he's doing one of his farewell shows at this bourbon club, which is run by Alec Baldwin and Russell Brand. Russell Brand's pretty funny in the movie. His introductions when the bands are coming out, nothing wrong with them. They're funny.
He's hilarious. If there's a disc out there of just Russell Brand outtakes, I will watch that to death.
Yeah. So Juliana Hoff comes to the big city, immediately gets robbed, gets a job at the Bourbon Room. She has dreams of being a singer. Meets, what was he, a bartender or a waiter? The lead guy in the bar, Casper Van Dien, whatever his name was.
It was not Casper Van Dien. What was his name? I don't even remember. Josh,
yeah. Drew. Drew.
Josh was his later name.
Yeah, so she meets up with him, and this guy's got dreams of being a big rock star, and he eventually gets to open up for Tom Cruise. Tom Cruise's manager is Paul Giamatti, who's just this real sleazy manager type guy. Yeah. Oh, Melanie Ackerman was a Rolling Stone reporter. I liked her in it, but I like her in anything pretty much.
Yeah, you do.
Yeah, I do. A little thing for Melanie Ackerman. She was in Watchmen. I don't know. Do you want to mention anything about this movie that you liked or didn't like?
Like I said, I liked the music. I don't know if I would have let Juliana Hoff sing that much.
But... No. Good to look at, not so much good to hear all the time.
I got way too excited when Mary J. Blige showed up. Like, I've never been a huge Mary J. Blige fan by any stretch, but I was like, oh my God, she was good in it, and she wasn't in it long enough. Right. It was okay.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't really necessarily hate the movie. I mean, it was better than I heard it was.
We got the extended DVD copy of it, so it was like 2 hours and 10 minutes or something.
Yeah, it was a long movie.
So we watched it in two parts. It's not something that, like, you know, lazy Saturday afternoon. Oh, what do I feel like watching? Oh, I'm going to put Rock of Ages in. I do, however, plan on putting all of the music on my iPhone. I love the music. I love the mashups.
The soundtrack too.
The mashups were amazing.
Tom Cruise actually didn't have that bad of a singing voice either, I gotta admit.
No, like, he actually trained, and I have a lot of respect that he didn't just go in going, I'm Tom Cruise, I don't need this shit.
Yeah.
And just did whatever. Like, he trained, and he physically worked out.
Yeah.
So that he could sing and perform properly. And he didn't sound bad.
No, he was all right.
His tattoos annoyed me.
Yeah, he had that one gun barrel on his stomach.
He had two gun barrels.
I wasn't
they
paying
were,
that.
They were the front hip tattoos, which look great on people and look great on him, but they didn't have those tattoos in the 80s.
Like, not
I didn't
really.
Know a lot of tattooed people in the 80s, but no.
Yeah, the guys I knew with tattoos just had them up on their arms pretty much,
yeah.
Or their shoulders.
And he had, like, way too many tattoos.
Yeah.
Because, like, even thinking back to when MTV still played music videos and you could see the performers, like, Axl Rose wasn't covered in tattoos.
Not like he is now, no.
Yeah, and, like, now he is. So it.
Or Tommy Lee.
Yeah. So it was kind of off-putting because I was like, no. No, these tattoos are not time-specific. Like, there was a lot that... It was supposed to take place in 1987.
Yeah.
Or 1987. 87. But, like... Because I was reading through IMDb, and it was like, oh, when she punched her time card, it said it was May, and the song they sang didn't come out until August.
Well, at the end of the movie, they make it like this dude had written Don't Stop Believing My Journey, but... I know that song had to have come out in the early 80s.
Yeah.
Right. So, it suspension of disbelief, I guess.
Yeah. Then the writers and the producers said, like, it's not meant to be a period-specific piece. Like, this isn't going to be on the History Channel. It's meant to be just an amalgam of the late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah.
But even with that said, like, his tattoos annoyed me. Like, he had one on his chest that, like, wrapped around to his nipple and stuff, and it was just like now, like, if Adam Levine got that tattoo, I'd probably be okay with it, because this movie was set back in the 80s. I'm like, no, no, I don't think they had colored ink for tattoos back then. That was something that was created much later. And he had the angel wings on his back.
Yeah.
He probably had a tramp stamp too.
Probably.
Because Lord knows those were totally everywhere in the 80s. Like, it was just annoying me so much. I was like, and I couldn't enjoy the rest of the movie because I'm just staring at these tattoos going, why? Who thought this was a good idea? Because they had all the other costume design and everything. The hair was amazing. That was all like full on 80s. Like, that's what we look like. I get that. She was teasing her hair really up high and then spraying it. And Jay asked me if I did my hair like that. And then I admitted that, yes, I did. And he thought I was kidding.
You wore all the bracelets and stuff, too.
Yeah.
My big 80s thing was I dressed like Sonny Crockett from Miami Vice.
Yeah, and that was...
I was big in the mid to late 80s.
But the tattoos were just annoying me.
Yeah. That's cool. spoiler alert to people who haven't seen the movie... But what did you think of the romance between Alec Baldwin and Russell Brand? Didn't see that coming.
No, I didn't. I love both of those gentlemen for different reasons. They played off each other so well in the movie. Like, Alec Baldwin owned the place, and Russell Brand was just his comedic sidekick, pretty much. And the one-liners they had off of each other were great. And then all of a sudden, Russell Brand was professing his love to Alec Baldwin. And at first, my heart was breaking because I was like, no, Alec Baldwin's going to turn around and be like, the hell are you talking about? Like, we're just chums. We're mates. Like, no, we don't do this. And then Alec Baldwin reciprocated and...
They sang...
I can't fight this feeling.
The REO Speedwagon classic.
So you're sitting there the whole time going, this isn't happening. No, no. Not that there's anything wrong with that. But no, no. And then, well, spoiler alert, they end up kissing.
Yeah.
But I was just like, wow. It felt forced. Like, I don't know. It felt natural for Russell Brand, but for Alec Baldwin to play that sort of role. And especially since, like, 30 Rock is wrapping up, and I'm all into the Jack Donaghy right now, and it's so not Jack Donaghy of him. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you want to mention the cameos in the crowd when they were doing their We Built This City, We're Not Going to Take It mashup?
Oh, my God. So I was so excited. So Catherine Zeta-Jones, just to give some background, plays the mayor's wife.
Mayor was Bryan Cranston from Breaking Bad.
Yes, he was. Who has it written into every contract that he has to show up in his tighty whities?
I think so.
Because he did in this movie. So she played a very Tipper Gore type anti-rock and roll.
And that happened a lot in the 80s,
yeah.
Man.
Yeah. Was it Metallica that got in trouble? Because when you play their records backwards and...
I know Twisted Sister and Ozzy Osbourne and guys like that were getting a bad
yeah.
rap back then.
And Tipper Gore was the face of that as the politician's wife, that she was against all rock music and all this stuff. So Catherine Zeta-Jones was playing that sort of role. So outside of the bourbon room, she was having a protest across the street. So her and all of her congresswoman wives and everything were... What were they? They were singing...
We're Not Going to Take It.
We're Not Going to Take It.
By Twisted Sister. Yeah.
Which was... It's funny that they threw that in there. Because they also sang the Pat Benatar song when they were in the church.
Oh, right, right.
Oh, I can't remember it. Hit Me With Your Best Shot.
Yeah.
Earlier in the movie. So anyway, so they had staged this protest outside... when Stacey Jacks was going to be there for his big concert and all this. And then all the rockers were outside of the bourbon room singing We Built This City on rock and roll. And I was so excited for this scene because Debbie Gibson, Nuno Betancourt, Sebastian Bach,
Kevin Cronin.
And I get them all?
Yeah, you got them
okay.
all.
We're all in the scene right around Russell Brand. So you didn't even have to search for him in the crowd. I was just so excited that they were there for that. I'm such a nerd. I was like, there's Jimmy Gibson!
Yeah, it was pretty funny. It was pretty funny.
So, it was, I don't know. And I guess there's a whole, another storyline that they got rid of.
From the play?
From the play of another couple. I'm not sure what their dynamic was, but they're not even in it at all. But they're in the play. So, I still want to see the play. Even after seeing this train wreck of a movie. The music was amazing. If you're into 80s rock, like I highly recommend it.
80s hair band rock.
Yeah. So, I don't know.
It's all right.
Like I said, not something I'm going to pop in anytime soon to rewatch.
I mean, I didn't hate it. It wasn't the worst thing I saw last year. I'm looking at you, Ghost Rider 2.
Yeah, oh, definitely not the worst thing.
But, you know, our thanks to Ryan for getting us a copy of it so we didn't have to go to the movies to see it.
Yeah, I got to see if Ryan...
And you were so excited last year to see it in the summer, too. You were messaging your friend Mark on Facebook, who's a big Russell Brand fan. You
as
sent
soon
him
as
the
I
trailer.
Saw the trailer, yeah. I put it on his Facebook, and I'm like, we need to go see this, and we never did. And there's probably a good reason for that.
Probably, yeah. But yeah, I mean, it's an okay movie. If you like musicals, you like 80s hair bands, go ahead, rent it, watch it on Netflix. Do what you, it's not on Netflix yet, but do what you got to do to see it. It's all right.
It will someday.
Yeah. Before we go, speaking of movies, something I wanted to talk to you about real quick. So J.J. Abrams is officially on board to direct the new Star Wars movie. First of all, it's 8 years since the last Star Wars movie. Did you ever think we would ever get an Episode 7? Because I sure as hell didn't.
No, I did not.
I mean, I thought they were just going to milk the Clone Wars thing for the rest of time.
Yep.
But as you're aware, in the last few months, Disney actually is the owner of the Star Wars franchise now. Lucas sold it to them. And they have plans to do another trilogy that takes place after Return of the Jedi. And we're not quite sure if it's going to focus on any of the characters from the old trilogy. Obviously, it'd have to be way after Return of the Jedi for that to happen. And there's been all kinds of weird rumors over the last couple months of different directors and things like that. So they've hired J.J. Abrams. And to me, that's a really good thing. because he was the one that pretty much resurrected Star Trek. Star Trek was pretty much done when he did his movie 3 years ago.
Yeah.
Brought that franchise back from the dead.
And got now, me interested in it.
Yeah, you'd never liked the Star Trek enough to... did you? You'd never saw any of the movies, or did you, before that?
No. My parents had watched the TV show, and I was kind of in the room when it was on.
Yeah.
But never got into the movies or anything like that either. Like, they watched them.
Yeah, I was never a fan of any of the TV series, but really liked most of the movies. Like, my parents took me to see most of them and just was a fan of the movies. But the one he put out in 2009, the one with Chris Pine, where they show the characters, the younger versions, I think that was great. And I'm looking forward to Star Trek Into Darkness, which is coming out in May. And here's a guy that he created two of our favorite shows, Alias and Lost. And I'm really, really happy about this decision. He's a great, great director, and I think we're going to hear good things about this Star Wars trilogy, and I think it's definitely going to be better than the prequels. That's my feeling on it.
We will see.
And they're bringing in Lawrence Kasdan as a creative consultant. He's actually the guy that wrote Empire Strikes Back, my favorite Star Wars movie, and he also wrote Return of the Jedi and a little movie called Raiders of the Lost Ark. So he's going to consult on it.
Never heard of it.
Never heard of it. And just for fun, I was going back through J.J. Abrams, his IMDb, just to check on some of his older stuff, because they said he'd been active in the business since 1990.
Mm-hmm.
Like, okay, maybe I've seen some of his earlier stuff. We've seen so many of his early movies that he wrote, directed, or produced, it's not even funny. I'm looking through it right now. The first thing he ever wrote, maybe you saw this, I remember laughing, was the Jim Belushi movie, Taking Care of Business.
I saw it.
Did you see Gone Fishing, the Danny Glover movie?
Yes.
He wrote that, too.
That was actually pretty funny. Rose and I saw that one.
The first movie I ever saw that he wrote was Regarding Henry, the Harrison Ford movie, where he gets shot in the head and reverts to like the gentle human being from a douche. He also wrote and produced Forever Young, the Mel Gibson movie where he gets frozen for 50 years, yeah, which I loved. I own a copy of it. Did you ever see the David Schwimmer movie, The Pallbearer?
Yes, I did.
He was a producer on that one.
He should not have done that.
No. And do you remember, of course, the movie that we own on DVD, Candy Cane, Joyride? He wrote Joyride.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, but... he was known as Jeffrey Abrams back then, which maybe we wouldn't have put two and two together. He wrote Armageddon, like one of my favorite Bruce Willis movies ever. He wrote that one. So he's got some impressive writing cred. In recent years, he's worked on the Star Trek franchise and the Mission Impossible franchise. By the way, he's got something in his contract where he's still allowed to work on those franchises, even though he's
nice.
Doing Star Wars, which was excellent. Because Bad Robot is his company are the guys that have been producing the last two Star Trek movies.
Yeah,
I don't think they all of a sudden want Star Trek to go back in the crapper, you know. So it's cool that he's allowed to work on these. And he's actually an interesting thing, because when they announced that Episode 7 was going to come out in 2015, I'm thinking, are they rushing it? Because mm-hmm. that's a little over 2 years away. They don't have a script yet. They don't have actors cast yet. Maybe they're rushing it. He's got it written into his contract that if he thinks it's being rushed out, he can postpone the release date.
Hmm.
So if he doesn't feel it's ready for May 2015, he could push it back a little bit. And that's what he did with Star Trek II.
Yeah.
Which I think is kind of good, because at this point, we don't want a crappy Star Wars movie, right?
Right.
We want something entertaining and everyone of all ages is going to love. Hopefully no Jar Jar Binks. So as far as I'm concerned, that was the best news I got concerning the Star Wars franchise. And if anyone can turn it around, I think it's him. Maybe Hurley will be in this movie.
Yeah.
We were already saying Greg Grunberg will probably show up somewhere, right? He's his buddy from when he was a kid who's shown up in all his projects. Super 8, there's another movie he directed and wrote, which was great. So to me, this is awesome news, and I can't wait to get more messages about who's going to be cast and, you know, what characters might be coming back. Because I'm a big Star Wars nerd from the age of 8 till now. And I've tried to get the kid into Star Wars as well. She likes certain aspects of it. She likes the Ewoks. But she can't really falter. She's 7 and a girl. And you didn't really see Star Wars till later in life, right? You
right.
were in your 30s, maybe?
No, we were dating.
We were dating. Okay.
27-ish.
All right. So, yeah, I'm totally on board with that decision. And I guess Ben Affleck was the runner-up for director.
That'd be
interesting as well. So, anyhow, that's our movie review segment this week. Hopefully, you've learned a lot from us. Hopefully, you didn't get too bored by our personal anecdotes. But we're going to do this every week. We're going to have some guests come in as well to help us out. I look forward to when John Ballmer and Ryan McNabb are here with us to see what movies they're going to pick. But we'll do this again real soon. So for now, this is Jay Stu and Kay Stu. And as always, we got the geek.